Europa. Here on Earth, vending machines could suddenly deliver anything. By now, Omnigates are an everyday appliance, like a dishwasher or a garbage disposal. Most people have one at home for throwing away trash or receiving deliveries. Ours is the size of a big trash can with a lid on top. We keep it in the basement. Turns out, knowing the pattern is enough to put things back together, but not people. The trip through a gate breaks anything that lives. What comes out looks the same as what went in. But it's crazy, spitting and screaming and dying within seconds. There's something, some pattern of the mind that gets lost in there. At night, with my husband asleep beside me, I've often wondered if the thing that can't find its way out is a person's soul. I think maybe the mortal parts of us get sent over, but not the divine, the weightless part that lives on even after our bodies are gone. The people in lab coats put one of everything through the gate, a Noah's Ark of insanity. After I became a mother, I watched the videos online. Monkeys writhing out with black eyes and bared fangs, choking on their own tongues. Pigs and cats and lab mice crawling out as dried, dying husks. Nematodes, the stupid little worms, they come through fine, wiggling and happy. Maybe worms don't have souls. Or who knows? Maybe they're just at peace? On the day Bee was born, I already knew something was wrong before we reached the hospital. The unborn baby didn't feel right, a painful knot inside me. My husband, Kemper, was holding my hand and grinning with excitement. He had a timer that he bought special for this occasion hanging around his neck, like a gym coach. But I just felt a deep, gut-wrenching sense of dread. Later, wearing a backless hospital gown under fluorescent lights, I fought to give birth. Hour after hour, I pushed, my arms swollen and marked with purple-blue gashes from the IVs, my vision flashing red from squeezing my eyes closed so tight. Breathing through my teeth, I tried to focus on the next 10 seconds. For 30 hours, I lived 10 seconds at a time. I remember the fat drops of rain that thumped like moths against the black windows of the delivery room. A freak storm was growing in the night, dark waterfalls cascading down from vacuum-kissed heights. As the gale raged, each droplet exploded against cold glass, pulling its neighbors down into the abyss. Doctors said the baby couldn't get positioned. Worst case, they'd order up a C-section and take her out that way. But I wasn't through trying. When the lightning storm hit, nobody came right away. The overhead lights blinked out and emergency backups flickered on, glowing crimson like dying embers. Nurses were sprinting through the dim hallway outside, yelling about a fire. Kemper held my hand, and we waited until a nurse finally rushed inside. One look at her face, and I knew. That feeling of wrongness inside me had become something real and hard and utterly impossible to accept. The surgery room was out of commission, the roads out. Necessary equipment was broken. Necessary people were not present. The baby was upside down, and she couldn't be born without killing me. In this storm, on this night, there were no safe possibilities and no fairy tale endings. Only premature goodbyes. I'm not sure when I noticed the technician standing at the door. Over his paper surgical mask, I could see his eyes were a pale yellow. Greedy, somehow. A rash of pulpy scars traced out from under the mask, veering up toward his ear. He was breathing funny under there, kind of wheezing. maybe from excitement at the emergency, or maybe from whatever deformity lay hidden. He shuffled into the room, carrying a dark promise. The nurse wouldn't look at him, but she gave the man his space while he went about his business. Speaking quickly, he said he was a technician for a special machine, a remote gate designed to remove tumors from the human body. Using it to target a baby would be simple, he said. A teleporter gate could be generated around the contours of my unborn child, and she could be whisked right out of me. She could be saved. There were no guarantees, except that B would die if we did nothing. I listened to his promises with my breath coming in sharp pants, sweat pooled in the hollow of my throat. Numb from the waist down, I was nearly delirious after a day of not sleeping and choking down Dixie cups of ice shards. Nothing ever came easy for my Beatrix, not from the very start. Kemper took my hand, already shaking his head, no. Tears were shining in his eyes. That stupid timer was still hanging around his neck. But the path had become clear to me. I can't lose her. I won't, I said. We can't, he told me. You've seen what happens to. Anger crept in, tightening my grip on his hand. No, was all I could say. You have to accept this, he said. We have to let go. Her name is Beatrix, I said. He closed his eyes and those tears did fall. She wasn't meant to be, he said. I can't, I repeated. I would rather die. The wind threw itself against the window then, blasting the wall of raindrops into random streaks of light and darkness. Honey, Kemper said, opening his eyes and wiping a forearm across his face. Whatever you decide, I'm with you. But please. Yes, I said to the technician. Do it. My husband's face went a little empty then. His military bearing crept back into his stance and his spine straightened up. This is how he survived deployment, I thought to myself. Going blank is how you make it through the hard parts. Kemper stepped back as the technician wheeled his machine over. It happened quickly. I signed a paper. Nurses gathered, murmuring. The machine splayed crooked white fingers of plastic around my bulging stomach like a skeletal paw. A strange humming came from inside it, almost like a tune. It must have been the ultrasound targeting, locking on to the baby inside me. For 1 second, I glimpsed her face on a grayscale monitor, pixelated and perfect, thumb curled in her mouth. My Beatrix was so close, I could almost feel her weight over my chest. I am your mother, I thought. I will keep you safe. An alert chimed. The machine was ready. The technician nodded at me, his feline eyes wide over the mask. Across the room, Kemper was silhouetted against the hallway lights. I could see that his face was in his hands, his shoulders shuddering. I raised an arm, the IV dangling like a puppet string. It will be okay, I tried to say. The universe will give us this one. After a flash and a puff of ozone, the world went still. The only truth left was the clear ringing in my ears, a simple song that proved I was still alive. Looking down at myself, I bit back a scream as my stomach deflated grotesquely, the slack skin falling in on itself like a building with a dynamited foundation. I realized I could feel the horrific alien fingers of the teleporter reaching inside. Beatrix was gone, The life inside me had been ripped from the warmth of my womb and sent to some cold, beautiful place.
Success,
whispered the technician. My Beatrix, tiny and perfect, lay inside a clear acrylic receiving chamber that had been retrofitted onto the machine. Squirming like a grub, steam was curling off her bloody body. She screamed just once, like she was surprised at her own existence. Is she okay? I asked. Nurses swarmed around the receiving tray. Between their busy elbows and hips, I could see only snatches of my now silent baby. They cleaned off the blood and amniotic fluid, throwing away layer after layer of towels, each less bloody than the last. Is she okay? I asked again, voice rising. Three sets of eyes turned to me over surgical masks. The nurse in the middle was holding Beatrix in her arms, the baby swaddled tightly in a clean hospital blanket. I saw fear in the woman's eyes, a quivering across her forehead. Three steps, and then the baby was in my arms, handed to me quick like a bomb. Beatrix's pudgy face was pinched and bruised from her time trying to be born. She was a dark-skinned little thing, with a layer of fine black hair covering her body and tiny tangles of black fuzz sprouting from her head. Her eyes were open wide already, calm and watchful as an old crow. My daughter was the first and only human being born to teleportation. Kemper's arms closed around my shoulders as he planted kiss after kiss on my temple and cheek. I simply held B and looked down at her. She looked back at me with eyes like a bird had pecked two holes in her face. Something's wrong, I said to Kemper. Look at her eyes.
Nothing's wrong,
he said, hugging us both.
She's got your eyes, honey. She just got them early.
And then B seemed to look past me, toward the storm-battered window. Turning, I saw only an empty wall of dark glass. Then I noticed how the dim lights from the machine were illuminating silver veins of falling water, forming a kind of pattern. The infant smiled then, impossibly, her tiny face crinkling like a mask. Goosebumps erupted down the backs of my arms and a sense of horrible regret settled over my heart. Closing my eyes to the sight of her leering face, I pulled the baby against my chest and squeezed her. Just a face spasm, I told myself. Normal. Normal for a sweet baby. And then I made myself think the thoughts that I needed to have. She is my daughter. She is my blood. When I dared to look at Beatrix again, that devilish smile was gone. The baby was fine. Every examination showed that. B had become proof that maybe, at a certain age, the gates wouldn't wipe a person's mind and force them to go insane. Maybe the brain of an unborn child was too undeveloped to comprehend whatever shapeless things lurked in that millisecond of teleportation. B was fine, but she was never normal. Over the next 6 years, Kemper and I watched our black-eyed infant grow into a beautiful little girl. She learned to speak a little, and even to read. She was small, but she had a laser focus that she wielded with singular intent. The things she loved were impossible to keep from her. We got her a kitten when she was 6. Booker T. Washington was a little pink-nosed ball of orange fur, with claws like pinpricks and the sweet habit of ramming his head into our ankles. We called him Booker T. for short. Kemper and I carried the kitten into B's room, both of us smiling and hopeful. But as we watched B's flat, expressionless face, our hope started to fade. Bee had other things on her mind. Sitting on her bedroom floor, she was hunched over, as usual, carefully placing her blocks one by one. The room was littered with toys, a chaos of color spread over every square inch of space. Kemper bent down to release Booker T, and the kitten tumbled and bounded around the clutter for a little while, ignored. After 10 minutes, Kemper left to set up Booker T's litter box. He tried to hide it, but I could see the disappointment in his tired shoulders. My mouth opened as he left, but there was nothing I could say to make be normal. I lowered myself to my knees, stroked my little girl's hair. "Oh, Bee," I whispered, watching her pick up another brightly colored block and replace it in a slightly different position. Looking into her face, I was startled, catching sight of that horrible little smile fading from the corners of her mouth. Eyes downcast, she was staring at the colorful blocks with dark fascination. I stood up, heart pounding. Dizzy, I stumbled over the chaos of blocks and toy cars and dolls, climbing straight onto Bee's little bed and looking down. I saw the wooden blocks hadn't been thrown randomly. No, each one was carefully laid in its place. Eyes blurry with sudden tears, I saw that cursed pattern. Bee flung herself onto her back, arms outstretched. The blocks curled away from her body in a perfect imitation of the shimmering depths of a teleporter gate. Oranges and reds faded to blues and purples, all in weaving lines that sprouted from my daughter in root-like curls and twists. The pattern of the gate was right there on her floor, frozen in its incredible complexity. And my Bee lay inside it, her black braids spread out like streaks of oil. "Sweet Bee?" I asked, not expecting an answer. "What did you make, honey?" My normally silent 6-year-old daughter looked up at me with her lips twisted back into that grin, her black eyes twinkling. "Inside," she said. I put her through that teleporter before she was even born. It was my choice to do it, because I couldn't lose her. She was so little and helpless. "No," I whisper.
"Pretty inside, Mama."
"Bee," I said, lips gone numb. "No, honey." The madness in those angles and colors was suddenly too much. Compulsively, I stepped down and began to kick the pattern apart. Bee howled and I kept kicking. I had to destroy it before Kemper could see, before my husband could realize that our Beatrix had been born into a different world. Our baby had sojourned through a nameless land beyond all sanity, and she remembered it. By the time Kemper came to the door, I was holding Bee in my arms, rocking and soothing her as she sobbed. I destroyed the pattern that day, but it always came back. Bee's coordination was delayed, but as soon as she could hold a crayon, the lines spilled out on reams of butcher paper. Somehow her chubby little fingers could unleash patterns of light and darkness with the precision of a supercomputer. And as she got older, Beatrix herself began to appear in the images. A little girl's self-portrait, made of black circles, lost in a storm of color. Sometimes, other shapes emerged in the drawings. Outlines of spire-like buildings with stairways at impossible angles. Smudges of color that seemed to shimmer like grease. And the primitive beginnings of embryonic, inhuman faces. Every new drawing I saw felt like swallowing a needle. Often, I would find Bee lying in her bed with Booker T asleep at her feet, surrounded by pages and pages of the uncanny drawings, the thick construction paper infected with that horrendous, eye-wrenching pattern. Sometimes blobs of crayon were caked into topographical patterns, like the landscape of an alien planet. Or I'd find hundreds of ragged holes that seemed to stare like the compound eyes of an insect. I got religious about throwing them away. At first, Bee would scream when I balled up her drawings and threw them in the trash. But that stopped when she realized where the paper was going. The Omnigate in our basement teleported garbage straight to a massive sorting facility somewhere else, thousands of miles away. Beatrix began to follow me around the house during the day, while Kemper was away working at the army base. At first, I liked having her near me. Then I realized she was waiting for the trash to be emptied. Once we were in the basement, she would stand on the next to last step. The plastic guard on the Omnigate mostly blocked the light from inside. But at that exact angle on the stairs, Bee's face would flash with the pattern. Bee lived for that shining moment. The harsh angles of her face would smooth, eyes drinking the light. Soon enough, I lived for it too. Seeing her in that moment felt like catching a glimpse of the daughter I might have had. I was watching drowsy television with Kemper well after Bee's bedtime, when the high-pitched shrieking launched us both off the couch. At first, I thought it was the squeal of metal from a car crash outside, nothing human, surely. But then I realized it. And other worse sounds were coming from inside. Kemper ran to the basement door and threw it open. As he thundered down the stairs, I turned and ran for Bee's bedroom. Flipping on the lights, I saw only the pattern in blocks again spread out around her bed. Bee was gone. Then I heard Kemper shouting her name. I found him at the bottom of the dark basement stairs, his back to me. The crackling light of the Omnigate casting his shadow across the concrete floor. The flimsy plastic guard lay on the ground, twisted off. And at the mouth of the gate, her body silhouetted by its hot shifting light, stood my little girl. In her arms, a wriggling mass of shredded fur was screaming and clawing pathetically. Booker T, insane, orange fur falling off his skin in clumps, was wailing like a human, coughing blood over her forearms. Bee! What did you do? I shouted. Kemper lunged forward and snatched the cat away, covering it up so that I couldn't see. Clutching the squirming bundle to his chest, he rushed past me up the stairs, halfway up. He stopped to look down at me for a split second. "Oh, my God, Bee," he said. "Oh, my dear God." As Kemper took the cat outside, I flew down the stairs to Bee's side. "Honey, honey, are you okay?" I asked.
"Kitty," said Beatrix. "I showed Kitty."
"Showed him what, Bee?" I asked, checking her hands and arms. She must have pushed him through the gate and pulled him back. "What did you show the kitty?" A familiar dark smile played at the corners of her mouth, then faded, like a sea creature sinking into the shadow of the ocean. This close, I could see the spatters of thick blood dotting the skin of her face.
"Inside," she said.
I watched my own hands leap away from her then, I could feel a stranger standing in front of me, an otherness that did not belong here in this world.
She's the wrong one, I thought to myself, closing my eyes. This thing is not my daughter.
Telling myself to breathe, I shut down that thinking. I opened my eyes and made myself wrap my arms around Beatrix, pulling her limp body against mine. Watching her bloody, expressionless face, I forced the necessary words into my head. I picked them up like a pile of bricks and I carried them with me.
You are my daughter. You are my blood.
I want to go inside, Mama, she said to me. Please?
After that, we locked the basement door. Kemper buried Booker T in the backyard with nothing to mark the spot. We tried to forget. I took away B's blocks and her coloring books. Lying in bed with Kemper, staring at a dark ceiling, I couldn't help but whisper my fears out loud.
Would it be better if she hadn't been...
Don't say that, baby, whispered Kemper, and I felt his warm hand close over mine. She'll grow out of this. She's got challenges, but we can do this.
Yeah, but...
I let it stretch out. She's our daughter, Kemper said flatly. To be honest, deep down, I knew Bea would go back someday. Beatrix is 12 years old on the day that it happens. On my way home from the grocery store, I see the smoke and stomp on the accelerator. Sirens wail in the distance. Our neighbors stand outside their houses, watching with concerned looks as flames lick through our roof line. I charge through the open front door. Kemper! I call. A haze of smoke clings to the air, but I can't see where the fire is coming from.
Bea!
I check her room. Empty. The rest of the small house is empty, too. I see half a graham cracker still sitting on the kitchen table. The door to the basement is slightly open. Hesitating, I pull it open wider and call into the darkness.
Guys?
Nothing. Catching a faint glimmer of light slithering over the concrete block walls at the bottom of the stairs, I take one step down and then another.
Bea?
The reinforced plastic guard we bought has been torn off the teleporter. An axe from the shed lies beside it, bluish light reflecting off the nicked blade. A low moan builds deep in my throat. Reaching the last step, I see my husband's legs. Kemper is lying on his stomach, but my mind can't process all of this right away. Legs. All I see are legs. Legs coming out of the shimmering mouth of the teleporter.
Kemper!
I shriek. There is an animal raggedness to my voice that I don't recognize. My breath is coming in high-pitched gasps. Falling to my knees, I latch my hands on his ankles and yank him out of the teleporter. It's like dragging a block of wood.
What did you do?
I shout.
Beatrix, what did you do?
With all my might, I roll Kemper over onto his back. He stares up at me with glassy eyes that have gone white. His brown face has turned the color of ash, withered and slack. His jaw moves once or twice, his tongue swollen and purple.
A long time in there.
He coughs out the words.
Honey, stay with me.
I chant. But his head is already falling back. A choking sound comes from deep in his throat. I lift his head as his chest convulses, trying to clear his airway. Then, seeing his twisted face, I realize that what's left of my husband isn't choking. It's laughing, trying hard to laugh anyway. But he can't. Instead, he dies. In shock, I kick away from his body, the concrete hard and cold on my tailbone. Something loud crashes in the fire upstairs, and I hug my knees to my chest. No tears are coming. Nothing. I can't feel my face. My arms and legs must belong to somebody else. I notice one of B's crumpled drawings on the floor, fallen before it could go into the Omni Gate. Watching myself move, I pick it up. I open the drawing slowly with shaking fingers. It's a picture of B, smiling and happy. She is holding hands with her daddy and mommy. The frenzied, wavy lines of the pattern warp the space around us. I turn to the teleporter gate. The glowing rectangle winks and dances. I can almost hear words under its static murmur. I can almost see her smile. B is gone. She went home. My blood. There are only so many relationships that exist. Only so many ways of being human. We start out as children, and, like puzzle pieces rattling in a box, most of us eventually find a connection. We turn into wives and husbands. Before it's all over, many of us find that we've become parents ourselves. And if we're lucky, we get to become grandparents, uncles and aunts, cousins and siblings. In the end, it's only blood that matters. Mama used to say that the blood of your folks and their folks was upstream. That's the blood that's come down to you. The downstream blood represents the ties we share with our children and their children. It's what we give of ourselves to our babies. She is my daughter, not a thing. A mama does anything for her babies. She protects that downstream blood always because it matters more than her own. When it's all over and we blink goodbye and let go of our last breath, it's only our blood that we leave behind. Staring into that infernal spitting pattern and listening to my house burn, pendulous tears finally well into my eyes. My baby is gone, and so is my husband. The gate took everything. Then B's thin brown arm lunges out of the teleporter. I shriek as her scrawny fingers lock onto my arm like a pair of handcuffs. The disembodied arm disappears into the pattern on the gate's surface. Trying to pull away, I stare into that swirling abyss. And her dark face materializes. Those black eyes that we share are wide open and twinkling with happiness. Her lips are curled into a brilliant smile as her head and shoulders emerge. For the first time in her life, she looks like a normal 12-year-old girl. "Mama," she says, "come and see." I close my hand over hers and hold on, repeating my mantra, pulling my forearm against her demonic strength. "Mama," she says, digging her nails into my arm. "It's so pretty inside." "What have you done, B?" I ask, Bee's eyes flickered down to the corpse of her father. His face aged 1,000 years. Her smile falters just a little bit.
You hurt your daddy,
I say, the back of my throat thick with tears.
It was too bright, Mama,
she says.
Don't call me that.
She frowns now, a dimple appearing between her eyebrows. She is my own sweet baby. I did this to her. Blinking, my tears come free and streak down my face.
What are you?
I ask. Bee leans forward, face brightening. Her breath is hot on my cheek and excitement pulses behind her eyes. Her fingers are so tight on my arm.
I'm your blood, she says.
The only thing we're given. All we can hope to leave behind.
We're the same,
she says.
Our eyes, not like Daddy.
No, no. She is my daughter. She is my blood, goddammit. I blink, and this time I feel no tears. I made a promise to my daughter.
I will not lose her. I would rather die.
Will it? I stop, losing my nerve. Taking a shuddering breath, I start again.
Will it hurt?
I ask. The glow from the gate shimmers and hisses. The hot light from it has never been reflected in her abyssal eyes. Those same eyes I have.
Oh, yes, Mama.
She whispers, smiling wide.
Foul weather. Some things you can't figure out, not even with a whole heap of scratch paper and a ribbon of data from a chattering teletype machine, not before time runs out. And time is like progress. She's not stopping for anybody. The answer is out there, though, in the weather. Foul weather breeds foul deeds, something my mother used to say. She said it even when I was a kid, before I ever went into the forecasting business, before I had a career as a young man, and then computers showed up, and the whole science of meteorology went and left me behind, before I became just an old man with his pencils and maps. Back then, I thought my mother was foolish. Thought she was just making it up off the top of her head when she said things like that. But now I know better. Those sayings come from somewhere. An old, forgotten place where time has worn the words down hard and shiny as coins. When I think back on it, I figure my ma had a lot more wisdom than I ever gave her credit for. Mothers are like that. It was a long, long time before I could sit down here at my kitchen table and gather the tools of my old trade. Before I could spread out an obsolete weather map and flatten it down without my hands shaking. Weight the corners, sharpen my pencils, try not to think of that damnable day until my maps are clean and smooth, the raw weather data bound and ready, and my theory on what went impossibly wrong finally laid out in crisp, clean pencil lines. Patterns of weather. Patterns of anger. The memory of Flight 7126 is a lingering wound in my mind. There is a woman's face that has stayed with me for years like a nasty scar. In the second before she died, her eyes were wide and black. Her lips were cracked with frostbite. When she spoke, I could see she had a mouthful of stained teeth. And even though it was awfully loud on that airplane, Her words sliced straight through the bedlam and rang in my ears clear as a bell. The flight landed safe, understand. The storm was rough, rougher than you can imagine. But all of us made it through. All but her. And the odd thing was, when we touched down, none of us passengers could seem to recognize the other. Husbands and wives, mothers and children, anonymous folks. The tires bit into the tarmac and we rolled to a stop with so many questions lodged in our throats. But, like I said, the answer is in the weather, see? On my map, I can chart it out plain as day. I don't need one of those damn computers to know what I'm looking at. Flight 7126 was headed north over the Arabian Sea, 500 miles east of Somalia, that gnarled horn of Africa rooting blindly out into the water. During monsoon season, the Somali jet stream comes howling off those barren plains and spills out over the open sea. And on that day, I believe the wind carried something terrible with it. I always take the window seat. As former meteorologist and chief weather forecaster for the 30,000 or so folks in Greater Sequoia County, it's almost a compulsion of mine to sit over the wing and watch the weather patterns unfold. I like to say that riding in an airplane is my version of a biologist's field expedition. I'm at peace up there among the cloud formations and fronts and thermoclines. You can plot and analyze the behavior of every weather phenomenon happening from the Ozarks to the Tibetan highlands, but the trick is to get out there and see it evolve. Learn where the patterns came from, where they're going, and why. Sure, a computer can predict where Jupiter is going to be in 1,000 years, to the centimeter probably. But I defy you to show me the man or computer who can grasp the full complexity of a simple country thunderstorm. It is an ancient and uncontrollable thing. The weather puts awe into my heart. It has since I was old enough to squint into a sunset. And this storm, let me tell you, she was magnificent. A towering armada of cumulonimbus clouds plowing over the sea in battle formation, bruised and throbbing, laced through with lightning strikes like impurities through marble. It was a classic configuration, a flanking line of rolling cumulus clouds, followed by the main tower, anvil-shaped, coming at us low and headstrong over shadowed water, dead flat on the bottom, but steepled 10,000 feet high. The sea down there must have been hot and angry, spewing raw energy up into the air, fueling that looming thing above. 1 minute the sun was hard and round as a cat's eye shooter marble, and the next it blinked out behind the beast. We were all of us thrown into twilight, and a dozen conversations trailed off. I don't know how to describe it, but the mood darkened. The engine seemed to drop an octave, taking on a hoarse wail. I could feel the vibration surging through the walls, straining against the floor under my feet, like a voice was trapped in the corners of things, trying to whisper secrets to me in a dead language. There was a perfectly nice older lady sitting across the aisle, a gray hair with chunky reading glasses and one of those wispy scarves around her neck. She was knitting with long needles, and I found myself imagining what it would be like to snatch her needles away, to dig my fingers into her graying bun of hair, push a blunt needle up under those reading glasses, over her cheek and under her sagging eyelid, hold her head tight as she struggled in my arms. The lady glanced over at me like she could read my mind. She had no expression on her face, just this dead, glazed look in her half-lidded eyes. I turned right away, dumbfounded by my own troubled thoughts, but not before I saw it. Just a flash, but unmistakable. A sudden snarl on her lip, there and gone. I got it then. That nice old lady was thinking evil thoughts, just like me. And then we were inside the storm. The armada had risen up from below and consumed our little pocket of air wrapped in metal. A spatter of jet-speed hail hit the plane, pinging into it like ball bearings. It was as if the storm were trying to skin us, trying to pry open every seam and decapitate every bolt to get at the people inside. The hum of the engines dropped again, and I'm not sure how to say it, but that strange twilight atmosphere took on real weight. Like diving too deep, the pressure crushing in on your sinuses from every angle at once. A few people started to cry then. The man behind me began murmuring to himself, strange talk about green waters and dead branches and gates. Right away I got this image in my head of how he might look with his throat slit. Head cocked to the side, tongue straining as he tried to gulp pressurized air. Blinking my eyes, I tried to shake the vision out of my brain, but the darkness of the storm had settled in. I heard him make an odd squeak, and then I made a bad decision. I twisted around and snuck a look between the seats. In that sliver of space, I found the familiar, overweight guy. He was propped back in his seat, uncomfortable, wearing a foot brace and a Panama hat, blue Hawaiian shirt, white pants. The guy had a silver pen gripped in one pudgy hand, and the tip of the pen, well, he had it jammed under the nail of his index finger, the broken fingernail tilted up and cracked like a ship pushing through an ice sheet. Blood was throbbing out in scarlet spurts spattering onto his pants. The fellow had a smile on his sweaty face, like a jack-o'-lantern with the candle blown out, eyes big and empty and dark. And giggling. That was the squeak I'd heard. I nearly jumped out of my skin when the flight attendant clamped her fingers onto my shoulder. What with me staring through the seats like a 3-year-old kid who won't sit still. I guess I was embarrassed. I put on an automatic, polite smile and looked up at her. My smile faded quick. It was her eyes, understand. A thin gold chain hung limp across her freckled chest, and her eyes glittered the same as the dull metal, just no life in them. Only the dead mechanical reflection of splintered lightning in the darkness outside. I tried to speak, but my voice caught in my throat, and all I could do was carp my mouth. I think that somehow she knew what was about to happen. She saw it. To this day, I remember that flight attendant very well, which is odd because I only caught that one glimpse of her. A skinny lady in a bad-fitting polyester blue uniform, smoky black pantyhose, little blue shoes with a gold buckle. Her mouth was open to ask me something, or maybe to tell me something. But the plane ripped open before she could speak. I remember her hair sort of shivered, like a wave of static electricity was washing through. Then the pale white ceiling dimpled in. A giant was knocking hard out there, asking to be let inside and not taking no for an answer. And then the raging sky opened up behind her head. Most people don't realize how dense our atmosphere really is. Honest to goodness, at sea level, people are like fish swimming underwater. Wave your arm and you can feel the nitrogen and oxygen bouncing off. But 30,000 feet up is a whole different equation. The upper troposphere is a place where the atmosphere is a quarter as dense as on the surface. You can't find 2 molecules of oxygen to rub together to save your life. Thin air, they say. It's the domain of storms and not of men. When the roof opened up, the plane itself groaned like a bull elephant after being shot in the lungs. Most of the passengers started to scream then, but not all of them. Some started to laugh, God help us. For my part, I was silent, still staring into the face of the flight attendant as the cabin depressurized. That furious African storm had rushed across the sea to greet us and had finally made her way inside the airplane. We were all together at last. The flight attendant was yanked up into the air like a puppet on steel gauge wires. That hole in the ceiling gaped behind her, a hungry mouth. Somehow her arms and legs darted out with uncanny strength, and she caught herself, newspapers and magazines and trash whipped past her and out into the raging abyss. Her eyes never left mine, even while they were filling with blood. In that instant, the flight attendant spoke to me. Her face was nearly out of the plane, and frost had already scabbed on her nose and cheeks. She perched above me with the tendons leaping out of her neck, arms splayed out like a spider, her bleeding fingers gripped onto jagged metal. Her lips were moving through a strained smile, and I don't know how, but her words found my ears. "Black planets roll," is what she said to me. It was then I saw her mouth was full of stained teeth. And though it was a vague feeling, I got the idea there were more rows of teeth in her mouth than there ought to be. She blinked once. Her retinas had hemorrhaged, and I thought of an extinct shark. She smiled down at me like the specter of death, and I wondered at the strength she had to keep from being torn from the airplane. I marveled at how her strange, urgent words had somehow cut through the cyclone and augured into the middle of my head. And since I'm being honest here, I'll tell you something else. I was glad when the flight attendant lost her grip and rude, ugly physics folded her thin body in half and she disappeared through that ragged hole. Glad. Because when she flew away, I felt the darkness go with her, flapping on bat's wings out into the heart of the storm. A human sacrifice. Here in my little house in eastern Oklahoma, I keep the windows open. I've always enjoyed letting the weather inside. I like to spread out the welcome mat, so to speak. Let her come on in to say hello and visit a while. The weather is all around me as I sit in my kitchen, plotting these fronts and pressure zones on an antique weather map. Even now I can smell the rain-kissed scent of the wind as it sweeps in off the Great Plains. My curtains twist in the breeze, and I imagine they're waving hello and goodbye. I have always loved the weather. Meteorology changed when the computers came and the field marched on ahead and left me behind. But the weather herself always stayed with me. You take the data and plot it and replot it yourself, see? Pressure rises and falls, fronts advance and retreat, and as the years go by, the patterns seep into your mind. You get a feel for how certain features evolve with time, where the weather came from, where it's going next, and why. Here in my kitchen, I get to thinking about that storm sometimes. The thing that enveloped our plane that day carried a kind of poison with it, I think. That's why I tracked her to where she formed, along the spine of Somalia, where a wall of hot, humid wind collided with a cold front falling hard and fast, with reams of historical data and pencil shavings and crumbling erasers. I followed that monstrous storm all the way back to where she was created. And that's where I found my answer. In the weather. Technically, it's in the history book open on my table. Genocide, you understand. My storm rose from a low plateau on the Horn of Africa. They say the fields there were clotted with the blood of butchered tribes. Women and children hacked to pieces. Over 4,000 people tore each other apart in a frenzy on the day my storm was born. A nightmare of rape and slaughter that went on until there was nobody left to tell about it. Not a drop more suffering left. Did the storm cause it? Or did it cause the storm? Hell, I don't know. It'll take a better forecaster than me to answer that question. Maybe some kid will sit down at a fancy computer and figure it out one of these days. Foul weather breeds foul deeds. My mother said it for years, and I ignored her. But she was right all along. We're each of us a part of the breeze and the rain and the sunlight. The weather is with us always, lurking quiet in the background of our lives. She's a punishing rainstorm while you change a flat tire. The breath of sweet wind on your neck as you kiss a girl out behind the gymnasium. And she is other, darker things.
The Nostalgist. He was an old man who lived in a modest gonfab, and over the last 80 hours his eyes, trademark, and ears, trademark, had begun to fail. In the first 40 hours he had ignored the increasingly strident sounds of the city of Vanille and focused on teaching the boy who lived with him. But after another 40 hours, the old man could no longer stand the Doppler-affected murmur of travelers on the slidewalks outside, and the sight of the boy's familiar deformities became overwhelming. It made the boy sad to see the old man's stifled revulsion, so he busied himself by sliding the hanging plastic sheets of the inflatable dwelling into layers that dampened the street noise. The semi-transparent veils were stiff with grime, and they hung still and useless, like furled, ruined sails. The old man was gnarled and bent, and his tendons were like taut cords beneath the skin of his arms. He wore a soiled white undershirt, and his sagging chest bristled with gray hairs. A smooth patch of pink skin occupied a hollow under his left collarbone, marking the place where a rifle slug had passed cleanly through many decades before. He had been a father, an engineer, and a war fighter. But for many years now, he had lived peacefully with the boy. Everything about the old man was natural and wrinkled, except for his eyes and ears. Thick glasses resting on the creased bridge of his nose, and two flesh-colored buds nestled in his ears. They were battered technological artifacts that captured sights and sounds and sanitized every visual and auditory experience. The old man sometimes wondered whether he could bear to live without these artifacts. He did not think so. "Grandpa," the boy said as he arranged the yellowed plastic curtains, "today I will visit Vanille City and buy you new eyes and ears." The old man had raised the boy and healed him when he was sick, and the boy loved him. "No, no," replied the old man. "The people there are cruel. I can go myself." "Then I will visit the Metro Fab and bring you some lunch." "Very well," said the old man, and he pulled on his woolen coat. A faded photo of the boy, blonde and smiling and happy, hung next to the door of the gonfab. They passed by the photo, pushed the door flaps aside, and walked together into the brilliant dome light. A refreshing breeze ruffled the boy's hair. He faced into it as he headed for the slidewalk at the end of the path. A scrolling gallery of pedestrians passed steadily by. Sometimes the fleeting pedestrians made odd faces at the boy, but he was not angry. Other pedestrians, the older ones, looked at him and were afraid or sad, but tried not to show it. Instead, they stepped politely onto faster slide strips farther away from the stained gonfab.
"I will meet you back here in 1 hour," said the old man.
"See you," replied the boy,
and the old man winced. His failing ears had let through some of the grating quality of the boy's true voice, and it unsettled him. But his ears crackled back online, and as the slide strips pulled them away in separate directions, he chose only to wave goodbye. The boy did not wear eyes or ears. Near the time of his birth, the boy had undergone direct sensory augmentation. The old man had seen to it himself. When the boy squinted in just the right way,